This is the time set for our second oral argument for today at the Judicial College. Case number 69333, Cain versus Price. Mr. Eisenberg, there you go.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Please proceed to introduce yourself and your colleague, and then we'll get started with the argument.
Did you want to settle the case? Or?
No, let's just proceed with the argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to thank the court and the Judicial College for the opportunity to argue the case here this morning. Robert Eisenberg, and the lawyer here.
All right, go ahead, sir.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes if I can. May it please the court, I'm Robert Eisenberg, appearing with Mr. Matuska on behalf of the appellant. The key issue in this case is whether a third-party beneficiary can get the benefit of a release in a settlement agreement, even though the primary obligor under the settlement agreement did not pay the money that was owed to the people who gave the release. And this could conceivably come up almost every day in Nevada when there are personal injury settlement agreements. Somebody's in a car accident, sues somebody else. They reach an agreement. Maybe $10,000 is going to be paid in exchange for a settlement agreement and a release. The paperwork is sent to the plaintiff. The plaintiff signs. The release sends it back. But then the insurance company or the defendant never pays. Would the defendant or its employees or employer, or the owner of the car, anybody else get the benefit of that release? I don't think any court in its right mind would say that a third-party beneficiary in that situation would get the benefit of the release, even though the plaintiff never got the money that the plaintiff was supposed to receive.
Can I ask you this? This is a little bit different circumstance. And from what I understand, release agreement, settlement agreement, there was a promise to pay $20 million without conditions. Could that be sufficient consideration for the contract? Well, when it wasn't paid, consideration could have been a new promise to pay the money without conditions.
Well, our position is, first of all, there was no new consideration, and with all due respect, I think that's the same mistake that the district court made here by finding that there was new consideration. The promise to pay the $20 million was already a promise in the promissory note. It was a sum certain with a certain date. The only thing the settlement agreement did is reaffirm that obligation, and it's clear from the language of the settlement agreement, and it extended the due date by 90 days from the date of the settlement.
So that was the only change, is extending the due date?
That was the only thing?
The only change. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble talking today.
Well, that was the primary change, I would say, was extending it. Everything else was basically illusory, we believe. But you can't confuse failure of consideration with failure to perform. And I did file a little bit late, but we did file supplemental authorities with the restatement of contracts provision.
Mr. Eisenberg, I'm sorry. The first promissory note promised payment of the first $20 million received from the proceeds. The settlement agreement said we owe you $20 million. How's that not different?
The promissory note was made at the same time as the joint venture agreement. The joint venture agreement provided a priority of payment. What the parties expected was that when the CMOs were purchased, that they would generate $40 million, that the Canes would get the first $20 million, and then C4 Worldwide would get the second $20 million. So those documents really just gave the priority of payment, but the obligation to pay the $20 million was absolute under the promissory note. And then, and if you read the settlement agreement itself says C4 acknowledges that it owes the money, that the money was due on, I forget the date, December 30th, that the money is owed. And C4 acknowledges that the money is owed. And then C4 is simply agreeing to pay the money again. That's why we contend that it was illusory. And so if you look at it from a failure of consideration, I think we win. If you look at it as a failure of the primary obligor to perform, we still win. Either way, what the district judge said here is that the day that release was signed, that it was valid and effective, and it had the effect of releasing the officers and directors of C4 Corporation, absolutely. Even if the settlement agreement was procured by fraud, even if C4 had no ability to perform, had no intent to perform, even if all of the security that was supposed to be there for the Canes, the CMOs, that had already, 98% of the CMOs had already been transferred away. So C4 had no ability to perform at the time the settlement agreement was inked, and no ability to perform in the future. The district judge said, basically, all of that is irrelevant, and the fact that the Canes never got a dime of their money, either on the joint venture agreement, the promissory note, or the settlement agreement, didn't matter. We suggest that can't be the law. And if this court affirms, I suggest to you that it could be, there could be mischievous implications for the future. Anytime there's a release, but the party who gets the benefit of the release didn't perform. Additionally, we contend that the release itself, the language of the release, is ambiguous. Not ambiguous, but it's very limited. It releases C4 from anything arising out of C4 Worldwide's financial misfortunes and resulting inability. There was no financial misfortune here. They stole money. They convinced Mr. and Mrs. Kane that they were leaders in industry and finance, that they had experience dealing with the CMOs, that this investment would generate millions of dollars. When at the day before the Canes sent up $1 million, you know how much money they had in the bank account at C4? $40. Not $40,000, $40. And then the Canes the next day gave them $1 million, and the day after that they distributed more than $350,000 to their officers, directors, and their families. So it was pure fraud. And then the release says that the release of the officers and directors from anything arising out of C4's financial misfortunes. And we just think that's not just ambiguous, but this clearly, as a matter of law, was not financial misfortune. Additionally, what I indicated is that the promise in the settlement agreement was illusory, that the district judge found, for example, that the new promise for the $20 million was actually new consideration. What the settlement agreement referred to as C4's unpaid financial obligations. C4 acknowledged that it owes the Canes $20 million. The settlement agreement said the amount was due on December 30th and remains unpaid. That was just a promise to do something that C4 had already promised to do. And under the law, if we can remember back to first year law school in our contracts classes, that's an illusory promise that does not constitute consideration.
So if they had invested $1 million, but there were zero profits, your position would be that C4 was owed $20 million?
That C4 owed them $20 million because of the promissory note. The promissory note. The only thing that the joint venture agreement did was allocate the priority when money started flowing in. The Canes wanted to make sure that when money started flowing in, it didn't get funneled to C4 and its officers and directors. So it set up a priority. The first $20 million goes to the Canes, and then, after that, then C4 gets all of the CMOs, 100%.
Is it from the proceeds? So if there's no proceeds, your position is that the Canes were still owed $20 million?
Right, under the promissory note. A promissory note is an unconditional promise to pay. It was executed at the same time as the joint venture agreement, which provided the priority for how the money would be distributed. The other issues in the case, and I would like to reserve the 5 minutes if I can, that there are other issues involving the attorney's fees, judge shopping. That's another thing we...
I'd like to focus on the question of whether there is a difference in interpreting the settlement agreement and its application to C4 Worldwide and its officers versus potential third parties. Accepting for the moment the reading given to this contract by the district court, particularly based upon the supplemental authorities you filed, it would appear as though there might be a different evaluation of this extension of the release agreement to the respondents in this case.
Well, the respondents in this case were officers and directors of C4. They were not named in the settlement agreement. The release part of the settlement agreement in its own ambiguous ungrammatical way. I don't know if that's a real word, ungrammatical, but it was not grammatically correct. But in its own way, it was broad enough to include officers and directors of C4. So they were unnamed third-party beneficiaries who paid no consideration, by the way, for that, and were claiming the benefit of the release even though C4 had never performed. And that's why in our supplemental authorities, the restatement provision and the comment clearly indicate that a third-party beneficiary does not get the benefit of a contract unless the primary obligor has performed.
As counsel, or as my colleagues have been asking you, if the view of this release agreement is different than your view, that is to say that the obligation to pay, the promise to pay $20 million derives essentially new consideration. How would that influence your argument with respect to the release extension to a third party? I mean, is this a breach issue, a failure to perform issue, under that point of view?
Well, our position is the obligation to pay the $20 million already existed under the promissory note. That the settlement agreement merely reaffirmed that obligation. And in addition, the settlement agreement contained a release provision. And so our position is not only was the consideration illusory, but because there was no performance, either one of those reasons renders the release provision unenforceable by the third party beneficiaries. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. And if I can, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Forsberg. I'm honored to appear before you as well. I'm a lawyer in Carson City. I've been practicing law in Nevada for 25 years, I guess, hoping to stop soon. But here we are. So I'd like to begin by pointing out to you that appellant's counsel is incorrect about what the promissory note attached to the joint venture agreement says. The exact language, and this is in the appellant's appendix of 1071, says that C4 promises to pay the amount of $20 million as per the terms specified in the joint venture agreement between these parties. So, contrary to what you've heard so far, the promissory note does not make an unconditional promise to pay $20 million. Rather, it makes the same promise that was made in the joint venture agreement, which is that the Canes and Heliops would be paid from the proceeds of leveraging the CMOs. So the promissory note, maybe it's not a promissory note under the definition that he gave you, but still, it incorporated the same terms as a joint venture agreement. So, absent any profits...
If you had a contract that said, you invest $1 million, we're going to pay you the first $20 million of the proceeds, what was the point of the promissory note? Why even have it? You've got a contract that outlines all of the terms of the business relationship. What are we to make of a promissory note that seems to state for value received, the amount of $20 million? It does say per the terms of the joint venture agreement, but that seems suspicious if it's not for the full amount.
I can't explain why the promissory note or the joint venture agreement were written the way they are. However,
I mean, this also expresses the view that this is a secured note, not just an unsecured note. Why a secured note?
Well, C4 was promising Heliops and the Canes a security interest in the CMOs. CMOs were purchased, and they had a security interest in them. And in fact, they've, I think by their own admission, their briefs have located these CMOs. CMOs are not fungible. They're specific aggregations of loans that people were buying at the time because they thought they could buy them for pennies on the dollar and sell them for a lot more. That was the program. So the CMOs that were purchased were intended to secure the note.
We accept your view that the settlement agreement created new consideration that provided a basis for contract. What's your view about counsel's argument that what did the release extend to? That's rather odd language in the release. Your clients and others are released from the financial
misfortune.
It's not a defined term, and frankly, I'm not sure I know how the parties intended it.
But that's not the only provision in the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement, as the district court noted, also contained language explaining the intent of the parties to resolve all the issues arising out of the joint venture agreement and the promissory note. They didn't refer to them exactly like that, but they talked about the secured transaction entered into on November 29th of whatever year it was. So that's what they were all talking about. If you try to interpret it some other way, which is that it didn't apply to the joint venture agreement and the promissory note, then what is the purpose of the settlement agreement? You render the entire thing meaningless if you interpret it to mean something other than they're trying to resolve the issues arising out of the joint venture agreement and promissory note.
Mr. Forsberg, then, is it your position that fraud doesn't invalidate that? That release is so broad that if for purposes of argument, it would include if there's fraud, everybody's still released?
Yes. It's as broad as you can make it. The cases actually cited by the appellants talking about release, there's one of them, I believe, involved a union. I'm trying to think of the name of it, but it explained that they would not broaden the release to include fraud, but in that case, the reason was that the person challenging the release laid out all five elements of fraud and the inducement to defeat that. Here, there's no evidence of fraud. In fact, I would point out to you that in the two briefs filed by the appellants, 55 times they alleged fraud occurred. Not once do they identify conduct that meets any element of fraud or fraudulent inducement. nor do they cite a Kids Court that lays out what the elements are. And I think the reason is strategic, that if they shine the light on whether fraud occurred in this case by setting forth the elements, they won't be able to draw your attention to evidence in the record of fraud. So, yes, I think the settlement agreement was broad enough to cover anything. Second, I think that there's no fraud that's been shown in the inducement to enter the settlement agreement. And third, as the district court noted, they gave up these arguments when they insisted that the settlement agreement is a valid and binding agreement. They will not step away from that argument. They will not challenge it on the basis of failure of consideration to invalidate it, or on the basis of fraud, or on any other basis. They insist that it's a valid and binding contract. That's how they pled it from the inception of this case. That's how they argued it throughout. And the reason is, they don't want to give up those five default judgments for $20 million that they got based on the settlement agreement, not on the joint venture agreement, not on any other conduct by the parties. So,
let me ask you this. There's an indication that not only were the terms and payment of the $20 million arguably changed in the settlement agreement, the addition of Dr. Rawson as an additional responsible party, the appellants have argued that that's immaterial because he was one of the fundamental folks drafting the JVA. How do you respond to that?
I'm not sure I understand your question. I'm sorry.
They're arguing it's really of no consequence because Dr. Rawson was the one who orchestrated the JVA, and he would have been responsible, I assume, is what they're arguing is that he would have been responsible under the JVA anyway, and it's immaterial that he was added to the settlement agreement.
I don't understand that to be the argument, Justice, but the joint venture agreement did not obligate Rawson to pay anything. So we follow the terms of the agreements. The agreement was that C4 would pay. There was no personal obligation by Rawson. He did not personally guarantee the note. He did not personally guarantee anything. In contrast, when the settlement agreement was executed, he did promise. And the district court found that in that regard, he executed the settlement agreement in his personal capacity. And in fact, that's how the appellants view it as well, because they have executed against, obtained a default judgment and executed against Mr. Rawson personally.
Worsberg, I have a question going back to this question about whether this is consideration or a performance problem. There may have been a debate before the settlement agreement about whether your clients, or I should say at least the corporation, was obligated to pay $20 million or was obligated to pay proceeds up to $20 million. What do you do with the section 1.1 under the caption consideration with this language? C4 Worldwide stipulates that it owes the Canes $20 million. And that said amount was due on December 30th. Now, why would the agreement stipulate that that amount is owed as of the date of the settlement agreement if your clients were only obligated to pay an amount up to $20 million from proceeds that at least as of that point in time apparently has never even been generated?
It's correct that they've never been generated and I think never were. I think that the reason that the settlement agreement says that is because whoever wrote it, and I don't think it was drafted by a lawyer, but I believe that what the import of it was that notwithstanding the joint venture agreement and its provision that the Canes and Helioffs would only do money from the proceeds, they were stipulating to this unconditional promise that they owe it and that it's no longer conditional.
Stipulating to an unconditional promise. are stipulating to this previous dispute and the resolution of this dispute. They say in this agreement, we owe you this money. Why shouldn't we take the agreement on its face? You're asking us to do that with respect to the release.
Right.
So why shouldn't we accept what it says on its face?
I think
we owe you the money.
I think that you have to go back to the joint venture agreement, which was, and the promissory note.
How can we look, what authority is there for us to look past the settlement agreement? We're required to examine the settlement agreement on its face and interpret it as a matter of law. Here it says, we owe you $20 million.
Okay, well.
And then it says, and we're going to pay you in 90 days. We owe you $20 million. We're going to pay in 90 days.
And we're going to pay a 9% interest on 20.
Question from a contract standpoint, setting aside the issues involving fraud and inducement and so on and so forth. The real question in the contract setting is how does the release, whether it's as broad as you argue or maybe more narrow as Mr. Eisenberg contends, how does it get enforced by your two clients who weren't parties to the agreement and are being released by virtue of their relationship with C4 and paid nothing?
Because the consideration in the settlement agreement bargained for that release. And the reason that you, in the context of the settlement agreement, it refers to the transaction. It refers to the transaction that's the subject of the settlement agreement.
So let's take Mr. Heisenberg's hypothetical that he began his argument with and is discussed in his argument in this case. Take a standard personal injury case where the claimant, agrees to accept $15,000 for an automobile accident. And as part of that release, they release not only the driver who caused the injury, probably a, let's just say hypothetically, a 16-year-old who was driving the car under the consent of their parents, but they also agree to release the parents from liability under the consent statutes. And the money doesn't get paid. Are the parents still entitled to the release?
Are the parents entitled to the release, or are they bound by the release?
Are they entitled to a release when the money isn't paid and the claimant files suit against the parents again or tries to renew its claim again against the parents? Can the parents take the benefit of that release?
But the claim that anybody has in that situation is against the party that didn't pay under the agreement. In this case, the entities or people that didn't pay are C4 and Rossen. And these appellants have pursued them and obtained default judgments against them. They could have obtained non-default judgments against them for breach of the settlement agreement too. They just chose not to fight it, I guess. I don't know why all these other five people didn't step up, but there's no mischief to be had there. Whoever promised to pay now has an obligation to pay irrespective to whomever it's owed to. In this case, those people are D.R. Lawson and C4. And I want to emphasize, too, that Price and Shackelford, there's no evidence, none, not a stitch anywhere that they cited to that indicates that they did anything that was fraudulent, that they made any false representations, that they knowingly did something wrong. There's no evidence.
Mr. Forsberg, did you have an opportunity to review the supplemental authorities that were filed last year?
I did briefly, and frankly, I object to them, and I don't think they apply anymore.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to to start by pointing out, Justice Tardesty, that although you read part of the settlement agreement where C4 acknowledged the pre-existing debt, you also admitted two additional parts which do the same thing. It's our position that the language of the settlement agreement sets forth the intended understanding of the parties who signed it. And you read the part that says that C4 stipulates that it owes the Canes $20 million and that the amount was due on December 30th. But what it goes on to say is that the parties agree that that amount remains, present tense, remains unpaid. And C4 Worldwide acknowledges its obligation to pay. That's also present tense. So there are four different parts in that one paragraph where these parties are agreeing that this $20 million was already owed. Also says that there's no evidence of fraud. This case reeks with evidence of fraud. I need another half an hour here to explain it all to you. But this case was thrown out on summary judgment, and all we're asking for is an opportunity to go to trial and to prove that fraud at trial. This isn't the place to try that. And then Justice Perry, you asked a question about whether Mr. Rossum, whether the release for him involved new consideration, and our position on that is that he did. He was the primary person within C4 who committed most of the acts of fraud. The others went along with it and were certainly complicit in the fraud, but he was the primary one. And so even though he was named in the settlement agreement, that he still, even before the settlement agreement was signed, he had personal liability and personal responsibility to Mr. and Mrs. Kane. So when the settlement agreement imposed that obligation on him again, and that's our key point here, all it did was say what already was in existence, and that is that he already had that obligation. And the other parts of consideration that the district court identified, we also dealt with those in the reply brief. So, unless the court has any additional questions, thank you, Your Honor.
May I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
Mr. Eisenberg, what of Mr. Forsberg's comment that you want it both ways? You want the agreement to stand for the defaults that you got, but you want it set aside to pursue other people. It's either a good agreement or it's not a good agreement, or is there something different?
Well, first of all, the case law says that if you believe an agreement is procured by fraud, you don't have to make that kind of election. You can pursue the fraud, and you can also not ask for enforcement of the agreement. That's something that would be fleshed out at trial. But the default judgments that counsel's talking about, at the time those default judgments were entered, the operative complaint was a second amended complaint. The second amended complaint had a claim for relief based on the settlement agreement, but it also had four or five claims for relief based on the promissory note and the joint venture agreement, the original fraud. The first default judgment clearly indicates that it's all the causes of action. And so it included the settlement agreement and the previous agreements. The second default judgment was based on the defendant's failure to comply with discovery rules. And again, even that default judgment indicates that it's both. So those default judgments don't establish anything in terms of an election of remedies. And the district judge actually specifically found that there was no election of remedies applicable in this case.
Okay. Any other questions?
Brian,
thank you. I would thank counsel for your excellent arguments today, and the case will stand submitted. You briefly introduced yourself.